the water position. This is very interesting. Water is about bladder and kidney. This is a bladder card in the water position. It's about your foundations of your energy. It's about your fundamental belief systems, your structure that you operate under. It's about literally about the bladder and the kidneys, not only as the main purveyors of fluids in your body, but also as the energy foundation and the battery bank of what keeps you running, and the literal structure of your body, the bones, the stuff that supports you in terms of your mental constructs of how the world's supposed to be, that hangs out here. Now, the other two sort of yin and yang aspects of the emotional world here, one end of this is that ability to be kind and gentle, and the other end of it is fear. This is where fear hangs out. Fear hangs out here. Love hangs out up here. These are the two dichotomies. If you're going to break down world experience, the human experience on planet Earth, it's going to break down to fear and love. Everything else is manifestations of that on the emotional world. Okay. In this position, you have a bladder card. And it's got a white circle around it, so it's a metal energy is involved here. And as we said when we looked at this metal energy, this is about the mind, mental games, definitions, that whole world, money issues, numbers, plus and minus, all that kind of stuff. Being the one
defining
who knows
the world is between
that
right
there
and
is
wrong.
Right and wrong.
That
right?
Yeah. Things are fair or not fair.
Yes.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. Those are mental constructs, and in truth, there is no.
No.
Right or wrong or fair or just or I mean that's those are all mental constructs that we've created over a period of time to try and of course control society and make sense out of chaos. The ones who went before must know better than we do, all that stuff.
Yeah.
That's all a mental construct and it has nothing to do with reality. Reality is chaos. In this position, this bladder card here, it's interesting. This one's tilted to the left. You see that because these are round, this one's tilted to the left, this one's to the left, this one's to the left, this one's almost upside down. It's a little to the right, and this one's pretty much out in the to the right. The right tint is out in the world. This is ego, social interaction, working out in the world. If they're tilted left, this is about your inner work. This is about your soul and your spirit and your willpower and that sort of thing. Okay, this bladder card in the water position is tilted to the left with a white circle around it. So this is saying that there's some issues here around your basic structural belief pattern. And because it's got this white circle, you look back here for the influence, your basic structural belief pattern around what nurturing looks like for you. What is your definition there, you know? And that's one of the major issues we're dealing with here. Okay, so let's see if this actually goes anywhere. So this card, white, goes into here, which is this whole earth thing. Both of these cards have yellow. They go back to this card, and these two guys are playing off each other because this is green, says look to the wood position. This is yellow, says look to the earth position. This is in its own position color-wise. So what's really happening here is there's this big transition going on in the way you define your nurturing, your self-image. The more you choose the powerful, empowered goddess energy that's available to you out in the world, the faster this transition is going to happen. The more this transition happens, the easier it's going to be to choose that power. It's not the book learning. It's whether or not you were nurtured.
And much of that is right in the nervous system.
This is not a mental process. No. Very physical. In terms of this reading, right, this is the process that you're undergoing right at this moment. So now, does this sound familiar?
Yep.
This is what you're undergoing, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, this card almost being upside down is that confusion of not being able to see where it's going.
Yeah.
It's not clear yet.
Yeah.
But you're in a major transformation.
Okay. Good.
Okay. Anything's possible.
Yeah, it feels like that.
This being the process, we're going to get a confirmation card here now.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh.
So it's a stomach card.
Right.
With a metal circle around it. So it's reassessing and redefining what nurturing looks like to you.
Yeah, this is interesting.
It's tilted to the right, and it's all about out in the world stuff. It's about your job. It's about where you're living. It's about how you dress, who you see, all that stuff out in the world. That's what this is about. Mm-hmm. That's what the transformation is.
Right.
Okay. The action required. Are you ready?
Oh.
Oh, boy. Okay, oh, so
this,
wow.
Yeah, this is a large intestine card.
Letting go.
And it's got a white circle around it. Right. This is a metal card with a metal circle. This is, again, this is like this stomach card, earth card with a earth circle around it. This is a double whammy.
Okay.
This is a powerful statement. And what it's saying is, it is time to let go. You're in this big process of just letting go of all those definitions, all that stuff. This is not like, oh, well, I guess I will, you know. This is like, you will now let go. Now, you see, you've got three cards here with metal circles around it, and this is in the metal position.
Yeah.
So this whole definition of nurturing, how it has to be nurtured, your self-image, all that's what you're letting go of. That's what it's time. All those old
ways of
those,
all that
stuff. And the beauty of this is this card right here, because as you let go of this incredible power, this inner strength is just going to bloom. I mean, it's like really going to come out. Okay, so I'm now up to speed.
Okay.
You see that? I now know what's going on.
Thanks, Kay.
With your emotional world and with what you're going through here. Like, this is like a year and a half of Freudian analysis just went down here in 12 minutes.
Yeah, and I couldn't have told you quite that way.
No.
No, but I can confirm that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now I'm going to lay out a session here.
Oh, okay.
Because here it all is, you know. So I'm going to work with triple warmer. I'm going to work with large intestine, some stomach points, bladder and kidney. How's your back been?
Oh, it's sensitive. Yeah, especially in the lower left.
Right on. Okay, so that's where this point is. That's where this point is. That's where this point is.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe normally I do a regulator release for the first one, but I think we're going to do a bridge with you. This looks more like a bridge to me. Well, there's a lot of regulator in here too, but the bladder and kidney really suggest bridge. So we'll do a bridge. So I'm going to do a strange flow release. Plus, we're going to toss in a little organ meridian work, and I think we'll probably do large intestine, because I'll check that point in your lower back and see if it is the large intestine shoe point, and that will confirm what we're going to do. Okay.
Many thanks to Michael Waters' inspirational guitar playing there, tolling on the line here so that we can continue this conversation in the present moment. Hi, tolling.
Hi there, Lynn.
How's it going?
Well, life's really good.
How good is it?
It's paradise. The sun is out. It's over 30 degrees, you know. Time to be naked in the garden. It's great.
And this is one of those days where there's no ferry traffic for Luskidi, isn't it?
That's right. It's one of our two weekends.
Yeah, right.
We have two weekends a week here. We have Tuesday and Wednesday when no ferry runs, and then, of course, we also celebrate the standard Saturday-Sunday thing.
Yeah, well, that sounds like you're almost spoiled over there.
I look at it more like the rest of you are deprived. We're leading a normal life here.
It must take a lot of pressure off the residents of Luskidi.
Means that you have to work more on your nap training and the more important things in life. We do have some different standards, you know, like the carpentry union here demands in the wintertime there's a 4-day week and you can't work more than 6 hours a day.
6 hours a day, yeah.
In the days when we had world-class ultimate team here, every worker could leave the job site at 2:30 in the afternoon on Wednesdays because we had a practice going on. So much to the chagrin of contractors hither and thither. Where are you guys going? Oh, we're going to go play Frisbee. What?
Yeah, but I mean, this was serious. You were like world class, weren't you, with all that going on?
Yeah, we got invited to world championships and things. Quite an amazing thing happening here for 12 years from 1989 through to 2001 or two, and a traveling team that sometimes was as many as, well, over 50 people, because we used to take a junior team, too. In 97, we took a full juniors team of 25 or 26 kids, plus our master's team and an open team, and we went off and did the Canadian Nationals, where the juniors placed third, and I think our master's team placed third that year. And
a good part of your population over there that went off.
Well, when you figure there's 350 people and close to 60 of them went off for a month-long ultimate tour, it was pretty impressive. Throughout that period of time, the thing about Luskidi that was so special in that ultimate world was that we maintained the spirit of the game, all about mutual respect. Ultimate's a very special game, and it's a game, not a sport. It's based on mutual respect, so you don't need referees or officials on the field. Everything's settled amongst the players. It's not competitive in that sense. There's a lot of competition in the game itself, but it's not based on getting the other guy. It's based on everybody rising to their highest possible potential.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes everybody to participate in that, like both sides. We put players on many of the Canadian national teams that went all over the world and played. We got quite a reputation for turning out really fine ultimate players, and most of that sprung from the fact that we had to engage the kids to play with us, or we wouldn't have enough people to play a game. So the field that we used was at the elementary schools. That's the first field that was built on the planet, designed and built for the play of ultimate. So we keep encouraging these young kids, I mean, you know, from 6, 7, 8 years old to come out and play with us, but we'd have somebody to throw a frisbee to. Well, when they left here to go off to high school or whatever, they'd already been playing ultimate for 10 years.
Wow.
So they look pretty good when they hit the national scene.
In those recorded conversations that I played in the first hour tolling, I'm wondering if you could fill in a little bit of the gap of how things have evolved. Like, how did you get connected with the practice of Shinshin-Do to start with? And how did that evolve over these last 28 years? Can you sum that up briefly?
It's a really modern discipline. It was created by a woman named Iona Marsa Teagarden, who is currently living in Hemet, California. She's the head of the foundation. The connection with British Columbia, and particularly with Luskidi Island, which is one of the meccas of Shinshin-Do, is that a fellow named Arnold Porter, who still has an active practice in Victoria and also teaches at Windsong School up in Campbell River, he left the island. He was looking for some way to support himself here. You got to remember, in those early days, I mean, there was no, like, jobs here. And there still aren't. That's one of the viruses that hasn't gotten to the island. We've managed to keep most jobs off the island. So he was looking for a way to support himself, and he ran into Shinshin-Do and took some classes and came back here to Luskidi and taught his first basic class, the initial class that you take in the program. And at that class, there was myself, a woman named Noelle Taylor, who has an active practice and teaches in Victoria now, Samantha Jennings, my ex. We all took this basic class, and it started a core group of people that went on through the program, took the different classes. At that time, you had to travel all over to get this information. It was quite vibrant and new at the time. We had to go into Washington State, down into Oregon, and different places to take the classes. But a core group of us ended up in California taking the teacher training with Iona. Back in 85, there was Doreen Backstead, who has a...
I know Doreen.
You know Doreen, Well, she's got an active practice over in Coombs there. She and Noelle and I all took the teacher training back in 1985. From there, this thing has just really taken off and exploded. We all sort of ended up spaced around the province in such a way... I mean, if you'd sat down with a map and said, okay, where can we put people that they're going to be the most effective and be able to establish schools and make this happen? You couldn't have stuck pins in a map better than we got distributed.
Pins in a map? Hey, aren't we talking acupressure almost?
Acupuncture? You couldn't make marks on a calendar. Yeah. We formed an organization called the Northwest Acupressure Teachers Association back in the early 80s. Which eventually developed into the British Columbia Acupressure Therapists Association. You can reach that at acupressurebc.org is the website. A society based on promoting acupressure in British Columbia. Maybe 150 members in it right now, including teachers and practitioners and students. It's a very vital organization. that helps promote acupressure. We have conferences, and there's a retreat on Luskidi every summer where people from all over the province can get together and let their hair down. We do yoga together. We do sessions on each other, and we sit around and eat a lot of good food and lay in the sun a lot.
And use that sauna too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, we do. We use the sauna, saunas and hot tubs, and doing acupressure sessions with maybe two or three or four people working on one person.
Now, can you describe a treatment? Like, there's three parts to it, right?
Right. Yeah, one of the things we didn't cover too much in that first hour was what the actual sessions are like.
Yeah.
One of the important things about this work is that it's body work, right? We're accessing the physical body in order to release the emotions that are trapped within the muscular holdings. And we do that through using the acupressure points. All of the aches and pains and discomfort that's experienced in the body has its root in the energy body. So by going in and actually working with the musculature of the body, by holding points at the insertions or the origins mm-hmm. of muscles, this releases the muscle, and that releases the emotional energy that's been locked in the muscle. So anger will come out, or grief, or sadness. And then you can work with that to get back to what the original concepts are that were being held in those muscles. The sessions consist of three parts. The first part is the assessment part. As we mentioned in the first segment there, most of the assessment that I use these days is the Danudec because it's so right on because it's working with the subconscious. But if you're going to work on the intellectual level, you read the pulses, you assess the face through what's called physiognomy, where you look at the colors and the wrinkles of the face. You do an assessment of the body by doing palpation. You feel the what are called the U points or the shoe points down the back. You actually massage along the meridian routes to see where there's actual physical blockage in the meridians.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most powerful forms of assessment is to ask the person what they want
and what
they've come there for.
Yeah, communicate a bit.
You got to pull out these extreme measures sometimes.
Yeah, right.
You do an assessment. You actually get into the kind of nuts and bolts work of actually moving energy around, releasing trauma, working with the breath a lot. The breath, of course, is the secret to everything. If you stop breathing, you've got 3 minutes and then you're out of here.
It
is a primal aspect. So we use the breath a lot to help open up different blocked segments in the body. You probably would decide which strange flow you were going to use. Because our discipline is based on the strange flows or the extraordinary vessels, there's different combinations of the eight extraordinary vessels that you would pick in order to deal with very particular symptoms. For instance, if somebody was complaining about a real low lack of energy, falling asleep in the afternoons, waking up in the middle of the night, this would indicate that they really needed a bridge release. So you would do probably a yin and a yang bridge release, which is about a 40-minute release. Okay, along with that, you would also pick out one or two organ meridians that you might want to work on in order to deal with very specific emotional issues. Okay, so you do that work, some emotion comes up, you do your counseling or your guiding or whatever, you get some insight. Then it comes time to sort of wrap it up, and at this point, hopefully, you've done a fair bit of balancing in the body. The person's achieved some sort of emotional release. They've achieved a state of comfort in their body. Maybe you've dealt with a particular pain, and they're beginning to really relax. Well, then the last part of the session, the third part of the session, is to do a really deep balancing release involving a neck release where you work up through the shoulders and the neck and then go down through the central channel, which is what we talked about with that card in the earth position in the mm-hmm. card reading earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You do the conception vessel, open up the chakras, and leave the person in this really deep, restful, balanced state. Then you give them, 5-10 minutes to sort of float in the ozone. Come back, bring them a glass of water, massage their feet. It's about a two-hour process, anywhere from an hour and 20 minutes to 2 hours, depending. I mean, if I've been working with someone for a few years or enough sessions to know what's happening, I don't necessarily have to do a card reading every single time. That can cut like 20 minutes off of a session. Somebody comes limping in using a crutch and they're pointing at their lower back and whining. You sort of know where you're going to start here. You don't have to do a real deep assessment. You get them on the table and off you go. So a session can vary from an hour and 20 minutes to 2 hours, depending on how much assessment's involved.
People stay fully clothed for these sessions, too.
You stay clothed. It's very non-invasive work. The amount of pressure that's used, although our school is a school of moderate pressure, the amount of pressure that's actually used is determined by the client. So if I start holding a point, and I mean, people have different levels of sensitivity. If you start to hold a point and the person says, ooh, ow, that really hurts, that's too much, well, of course, you back off. And you work with the person to determine what level of pressure they want to work with. Person lies on their back on a massage table. Usually we put something under the knees to just take the pressure off the lower back. In this climate, except for these few glorious months of summer we get here, usually the person's covered with a blanket. So it's very non-invasive, comforting, secure work that we do. And of course, everything we do is based in confidentiality. It's a safe zone. We try to create a safe zone for people because the subconscious and the emotional body is not going to reveal itself unless it feels it's in a safe, non-judgmental space. That's one of the things that we strive to create.
Yeah, working with the unconscious and how traditional Chinese medicine doesn't really address things that would come up in terms of past abuse issues or earlier childhood or even past life issues that might surface. So how does that work differently for you?
We're totally focused on that stuff. That's what we're trying to get at. This is one of the magical things that Iona Teagarden did. I just can't honor her enough for the organizational energy that she put into creating this discipline. What we're trying to do and what we try to teach people, and this is one of the reasons the Danudet came into being, is that we're trying to teach people to think in another mindset. Rather than thinking in the Western lineal mindset, A plus B equals C plus D equals E, you know, that lineal mindset, we're trying to help people to think in a holographic sense.
Holographic.
Everything weighs on everything else. It's not just A plus B. It's A plus B, 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 B plus C, C, C. I mean, it's all part of the whole. The damaged finger or the sore lower back, these are all just entries into this magical world of emotional exploration. So by going into somebody's lower back where they've got pain between lumbar 2 and 3 there in the lower back, you go in and you hold that point, and sure enough, you're going to start exploring support issues. Fear is going to come up. Maybe some frustration or anger is going to start coming out of there. You work with that. You start to explore the early part of a person's life as to just exactly where this fear originated from. If you can find out where the fear came from and why the person has to hold this in their lower back, that pain will go away. Over and over again, this is how it works. If you can express the emotional holding, if you can get not only a mental understanding of what's going on there, but also get the physical release and the emotional release that goes along with whatever the holding is, then you've dealt with the problem. It's amazing how many times working with these points, things happen that people say, wow, I don't remember that happened, but now I do. Grandpa jumps out of the closet, you know, I mean, oh, wow, yeah, well, there was this one time, you know. Our minds are so strong at masking and hiding this stuff, particularly when we're not able to cope with it. If we're young or if we're in a vulnerable situation and things happen that we just can't deal with, we tend to like put it behind us or suppress it. But it doesn't really go anywhere. It gets locked in the body. When you can deal with it or when your body can no longer stand to hold this stuff, it starts to make itself known. And the aches and pains that we experience, this chronic stuff that comes up, is the way that the body, the subconscious, communicates with us. It says, look here, look here. You got to start looking here. And if you don't, eventually it goes really physical. And this is where organ failures start to happen or muscle groups stop playing altogether or a nerve will pinch and you can't walk. Eventually you have to look at this stuff or not.
Yeah, or not.
And if you choose not to, well, the ante keeps going up.
So you make use of dreams as well?
Yes, any imagery that we possibly can. Like when we're teaching the program here on Luskidi, we do a very intensive immersion type situation. People come, they stay with us. It's a 24/7 kind of an atmosphere where in the morning we get up, we do dream analysis, we do Qigong, We eat great food right out of the garden, and we'll spend up to 7 days working on people's psyche and their emotional body, and the dreams get more and more vivid. Dreams are how the subconscious communicates with the conscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody says, oh, I don't dream. Well, everybody dreams. Whether you remember your dreams or not, that's another story. But everybody dreams. In fact, most people are dreaming when they walk around in this world. They're dreaming up their reality.
Yeah.
It's becoming conscious that you're doing that that is one of the major steps towards really getting some balance and some understanding of who you really are. So we work a lot with dreams and with imagery. Like when we're exploring the body, as you experienced, when someone pushes one of these acupoints, there's definitely sensation involved.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we do is encourage people to focus in on those sensations, to breathe into those sensations and to be aware of colors, of what the actual sensation is. For instance, if I push on a point and you go, ow, that hurts, that's just a programmed response, you know? If you hold the point, you say, well, now, what does it really feel like? Is it bruised? Does it feel sore? Does it feel hollow? Is it sharp? Is it hot? I mean, there's all of these different actual flavors that these points have. And when a person starts to become conscious of these different flavors and starts to really explore what they're actually feeling in their body, not just responding with the cage of monkeys. It says, oh, there's something different than what we normally feel. That hurts. Say, ouch. And they actually start to say, oh, wow, that feels really deep. That's sore. It feels like an old rusty knife's been stabbed in my back.
Then you get into, as you say, into imagery, and you link that into other things that are going on, because we use a lot of imagery like that, like you'd mentioned at one point, biting off more than you can chew,
exactly.
And who's the pain in your butt, and you know, that type of thing. I mean, we do translate and interpret things a lot through body imagery.
That's what we're looking for in this work, right? You're going along, somebody says, oh, that hurts, that's sore, or oh, it feels good, oh, that doesn't feel good. Oh, that feels like a snake biting my knee. Well, what are you going to focus on there?
Right? Yeah.
What kind of a snake is that biting your knee? I mean, there's the opening to the subconscious, right?
Yeah.
This is where your subconscious mind drops this little gem out there. This little red flag is waving, and this is the opening that you've been looking for. So you start to explore that imagery. Here's an example, right? Never saw her before in my life. We're out in an alder grove. I'm releasing a point in her back, which is about relationships. She's got her eyes closed. She's breathing. Any imagery coming to you, or you know, what's happening? And she says, well, I'm seeing red. Okay. Well, as a practitioner, I have to be able to go with my own intuition here.
Right.
That's part of what the Danya Deck's about as well, is teaching people to trust their intuition. Swimming, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know how that popped out of the deck there, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So this woman says, I'm seeing red. And I said, what does it smell like? Okay. Red, what's the smell of red?
Yeah.
Okay, this is a crazy question.
It is kind of crazy.
It is, because we know red is a color and it doesn't have a smell. But what does red smell like? She says it smells like smoke. I said, where's the fire? She says, it's in the cockpit of my husband's plane. What happened to your husband? The plane crashed and he was killed.
Oh.
Okay. This had happened 20 years before. She had never admitted that her husband was dead. That was the first time that she actually acknowledged the death of her husband. She'd been 19. He died in a plane crash. She'd never seen the body. She'd never been allowed to grieve. It was all pushed under the carpet. And
wow.
20 years later, out of the color red, smelling like smoke, we got to that. And she was able to let go of it. She was able to grieve it. She was able to move on from there. And it was this huge transition for her.
It's funny. Things like that, I mean, they've just become such a familiar part of our emotional scenery that there's no perspective on them until a light comes onto them somehow.
Yeah. Your body will try to draw that light. You know, these little aches and pains, that feeling between your shoulder. Anybody who's been through a breakup with a partner has had that feeling between their shoulder blades that they just can't reach, that marble, that knife in the back kind of feeling. This is the pericardium meridian acting up. This is a part of the bladder meridian saying, you know, you have to deal with the grief and the sadness around this breakup. And it usually takes a while, you know. It usually takes a couple of months before somebody can actually you know, let go of all the mental anguish and all that around a transition like that, to deal with the grief and the sadness. And that comes out of that point in the back, and you go in and hold that point, and bang, there it is. Anyone who's been in this work any amount of time, and it's not just Jinshin Do. Jinshin Do is one particularly really powerful modality to access the emotional body. You know, there's lots of disciplines which focus on the emotional body. There's myriad of miracle stories about releasing that emotional body and healing happening.
It's a very powerful combination to do the body work with the emotional aspect as well, to put those together.
It's just so powerful. Before I got into Jinshin Do, I had a practice in massage, and I'd been doing massage for 10 years, and I kept noticing that people kept holding their emotions in the same places, mm-hmm. and that if you release certain parts of the body, certain things came out, and I was really wanting to find out, you know, how this was all tied together.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, at the time, there was absolutely nothing in the West on it. But when I found Jinshin Do, it really answered those questions and showed how it was all connected, how it was all tied together. And not only that, but how you could access it. I mean, releasing it's one thing, right? This is kind of like kicking leaves out of a ditch with water flowing down it. But you got to give it somewhere to go. And
right.
That's the other thing
right.
about Jinshin Do. I mean, it's one thing to re-traumatize or to bring the information out into the conscious world. But if you don't do something with it, it just re-solidifies. So you have to be able to take it somewhere or to resolve it. And that's where Jinshin Do really shines.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do open up these channels of energy in the body and you get the person connected with the cosmic flows through their body and it balances out.
Mm-hmm.
It actually resolves. I think that really the proof is kind of in the pudding here in terms of the longevity of any discipline. I mean, if it's real, it survives. If it's not, it goes by the wayside. I mean, you look at Jungian analysis, for instance. I mean, it's been around for, you know, almost 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it survives is because it actually works. The same thing's true with Jinshin Do. Iona started this work in the mid to late 70s and started doing her teacher trainings in the 80s there, the early 80s. I took the teacher training in 1985. And at that time, maybe you can remember, Lynn, there was, I mean, discipline of the week, you know?
Yeah.
Geez, everything would come down the street. You could be doing everything. And if you look around today at what disciplines are still available on this coast or in the world, Jinshin Do is one of the primary disciplines that's still surviving. And it's available all over North America. It's available in Europe, Australia. It's a very vital, vibrant discipline that continues to grow.
Jinshin Do, what exactly does it mean?
It translates as the path of the compassionate spirit or the way of the compassionate spirit.
Uh-huh.
This is a catch-22. We're a Taoist five-element school.
Right.
We talked about the five elements mm-hmm. earlier, which is different from most Eastern schools. Most Eastern schools are eight principle schools. It's just a whole different thing. I don't want to get into it. But being a Taoist five-element school, Taoism is one of those schools that's based on the yin-yang principle.
Mm-hmm.
The yin-yang principle, oftentimes you see the yang side, which is supported by the yin, but you don't see the yin side. It kind of comes on later.
Mm-hmm.
The name Jinshin Do, it's the way of the compassionate spirit. You think of the compassionate spirit on you help people, you have to have compassion working for these people. What's really happening, which is the kicker here, is that you're actually working on yourself as you do this work.
Mm-hmm.
And you are creating yourself. You're turning yourself into a more compassionate person and moving on the path of compassion and spirit as you do this work. I mean, in the nature of what this work is like, you know, I've been doing this for 20-some years. I've been working in body work for over 30 years. And you cannot do this work and hear the stories you hear and be with people reliving the traumas that they
mm-hmm.
go through
mm-hmm.
and not open your heart.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess that kind of steps right into the next question is, how has all of this changed your life, Toling Jennings?
Hasn't affected me at
no,
all.
No, not at all. No.
Well, I moved into a world of service, really.
Mm-hmm.
My perspective has changed. For one thing, I really do see that it is a holographic world. More than just putting words to it, we really do create our realities.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean that in the very specific, most mundane, fundamental aspects of life on planet Earth, we create the stuff that we're involved in.
Mm-hmm.
That's become very real to me. It has made me a much more compassionate person for myself. I no longer will put up with a lot of the stuff that I used to put up with.
In yourself or?
In myself, mm-hmm. absolutely. Mm-hmm. Cleaning up my act, getting rid of toxic, destructive behavior patterns. I mean, you have to do that.
Yeah.
If you're going
yeah.
to stay with this work, you got to walk the walk, you know?
Yeah.
If you just talk the talk, you don't last long because
mm-hmm.
people see through it.
Yeah.
You actually have to work on yourself. Jinshin Do has created the stage and demanded in terms of if you're going to play on the stage, you have to work on yourself. And I think that's been one of the most powerful things that I've learned from this. Because we create our own realities, because the worlds that we live in are generated from our emotional states and from our constructs as to how the world has to be, if you want to change the world, then you have to change those constructs and you have to work on yourself. And I think that's been the lesson for me out of all this. So I do work on myself. I get a lot of body work. I try to consistently be truthful to my spirit, listen to my soul, and follow my spirit path. What we were talking about there during the card reading about the soul residing in the liver and mm-hmm. the spirit residing in the heart and willpower being in, down in the kidneys. I mean, these are intellectual concepts, but if you actually get into it and when a situation presents itself and you take that moment to stop and listen to your spirit and your spirit voice comes on and says, go for it. This is what you've always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you do, well,
hey,
then that voice gets louder.
Yeah, exactly.
If you listen to the Cage of Monkeys and you say, oh, well, I can't do it because if you do that long enough, then the voice gets really quiet. All of this stuff around, you know, the inner child thing that was so big a few mm-hmm. years ago, finding the inner child, you know, you go down into the depths and you find this creature that's almost always in bad shape, cowering in a corner in a dark room or something.
Yeah, it's been so ignored.
Ignored.
Yeah.
Well, this is what happens to your spirit when you don't listen to it. It eventually gets very depressed and ends up sitting in a dark corner somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the more you listen to it, the stronger and more vital and vibrant it becomes. And eventually, you can't imagine not
yeah.
following your spirit, regardless of the consequences, which is one of the most fascinating parts of this whole thing.
Well, yeah, because it's kind of reckless, but it's so magical and joyous, really, when it really shines forth, like you say.
Exactly. It's like you're on a train, and you're rushing down this track, and you get this urge to jump off the train, and your mind goes nuts, and your spirit's saying, come on, jump off the train, jump off the train. You think, man, I'm going to get hurt if I do that. And eventually your spirit takes over, and you jump off the train, and you land, and you're not hurt. And 3 minutes later, the train goes off a trestle, and everybody's killed.
Yeah, right. Got to be careful about following that voice, too. I mean, it can get you in trouble, but it's just being discerning, really.
That's where all the rest of it comes in, you know. Your spirit may think that you can jump off the 30th floor and flap your wings and you'll actually be flying. Well, yes,
yeah,
that's true for about 7 seconds. And it's your kidney's job, that fear aspect, to control the spirit and the fire. And it's saying, dude, get a grip.
Yeah.
So there's control mechanisms, and it's all tied together. It's been a very challenging experience for me to actually submit to that higher knowledge, to trust in that. I went through some really traumatic times. I grew up in America to start with, and then I organized draft resistance and stuff during the war in Vietnam and was in some very traumatic situations. And by the time I got to Canada, looking back on it now, I was a very damaged unit, especially around issues of trust and power over governments, authority, all that kind of stuff was
mm-hmm.
just huge. It took me years to get around to being able to look at that. But I can really see now that, you know, my spirit was battling with all that stuff to get me here
mm-hmm.
so that I could get in touch with this knowledge and ground this energy on the West Coast and in British Columbia in particular. I knew when I came to Canada, and this is 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Yikes.
Don't think about it too closely.
Yeah, really. I was coming here to put a center together. I was coming here to create a place for healing. You know, at that time, I was thinking of all the burnouts in the anti-war movement because
mm-hmm.
we were all working 24/7 to try and turn that thing around, which we did. I mean, we did end the war and topple the government, after all. But anyway, above and beyond that, I knew I was going to create a space and create a place for people to come and heal, and I thought it was all revolved around that, but it turned out it wasn't. But I knew that this direction was there. So I was following my spirit even then. I just, as often happens, I didn't have a clue as to where it was going.
And here you are now. And Tolling, we're out of time. It was really quick, and I wish that we could talk longer.
And, well, Lynn, what a great lot of fun.
Well, totally, Tolling, yeah.
And how's the transition going, by the way?
I would say it's going really well. In fact, I had this great dream last night of going along, and then this elephant, this huge elephant, suddenly popping out of this very small spot, like where you'd hardly think an elephant could emerge from, followed by a baby elephant. And I thought that was amazing.
That's wild.
I love that. You know, it was like, oh, are there elephants on this island? And then I was walking along, and I saw these elephants walking by, two sets of parent and child going along the beach, and I was watching other people to see if they even noticed them, and no one even seemed to notice. To me, like, an elephant is a symbol of auspicious fortune and opportunity, which is a lot of what's up right now. To me, that symbolizes that kind of thing is around us all the time.
Indeed.
And it's really if you want to pay attention and notice or not.
Indeed. Yes, and I encourage you to nurture your baby elephant.
Oh, yes.
If anyone would like to get in touch with what I'm up to, they can check me out on my website at shenjourney.com. They would like to pursue a session with Jin Shin Do.
Perfect.
Great.
Thank you so much, Tolling.
Okay, Lynn. It's been a gas.
It's been great.
Later.
We'll talk to you soon. Bye for now. And that was Tolling Jennings, live from Luskiti on the phone.
How was that last little bit of the session there when you were doing those deep breaths at the end?
To compare it to the beginning, the pressure seemed pointed and focused, and by the end it just felt like everything was just mellowed out and evened out. Yeah, it just felt like, yeah, balanced out. That's the whole point, right?
that is the actual point, is to come back into balance.
Yeah.
It's experiential.
Yes.
Yeah, partway into the shoulders, and you had that experience of compassion for yourself.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Can you tell us a bit more about that?
I thought of myself at this point, a little peak on top of this long overview of all of my life that had led up to now, and just feeling this compassion for everything I've gone through that needed to happen, obviously, for me to be exactly where I am now, because I just love where I am right now. And my body felt really, really long, like almost as if my toes were reaching my conception point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was very unexpected. Mm-hmm. Thought I was just going to tell you this dream and how great it was, but...
Dreams are the subconscious communicating, right?
Yeah.
And to have that come forward out of a dream...
Yeah. Today I'd like to talk to you in the inspiring moment about the practice of talking with oneself. I'm used to talking with myself off and on for over many years of my life. I think it's a way I've kept in touch with myself, to hear my own voice over the din of many external voices, opinions and ideas that are not my own, to find my own unique voice. There's such a stigma about talking with oneself. When you see someone walking down the street talking away to themselves, you immediately look for a supporting feature, a cell phone held at their ear, or someone beside them who you can't see. If they're actually talking out loud to themselves, there's a tendency to see them as somewhat unbalanced or eccentric, somehow outside of the acceptable way of being in society. I heard from someone recently who was marveling at the idea of talking aloud to oneself. It wasn't something she'd ever done, she said, other than in the grocery store when reviewing her shopping list. When her child was small, she would read through it aloud, knowing that it would seem that she was talking with her child. And still, years later, does this out of habit, and actually notices that other women do this too. Do you talk to yourself out loud? It serves good purpose, this practice. It gives me a chance to hear what my voice is saying quietly on the inside. It gives me a chance to say out loud things I need to hear, to encourage me, remind me, clarify to me ideas as they appear, plans as they are being sketched out, inspiration that gives my life meaning. The reason that this is up in my attention right now is that I went for a long walk last week, and once I got beyond the houses and people and cars into a country lane with just me and the trees, birds, and breeze, I found I immediately began to speak aloud, stream of consciousness, like the words had just surfaced in a pool of thoughts, splashing about as they breathed air and suddenly had dimension, surprising me with the energy and the need to speak with which they were being expressed. Even still, at moments I felt a hesitation, and why would that be? To me, it illustrates years of habit of second-guessing oneself in relative terms to what others think, considering how one appears, even in the form of one's thoughts. Beyond the soundless thoughts of our internal dialogue, speaking aloud in our own presence is a commitment of a kind that echoes through the heavens, which is in contrast to the collision sometimes that can occur when our expression meets with either the receptivity or the rejection of others. And of course, then there's the power of thought, knowing that once put into conscious thought and spoken word, ideas have tremendous power to clarify intention and alter the direction of one's life. This inspiring moment of Living on Purpose. Music has been by Michael Waters from his CD, Famous in Mongolia. I thank you for listening to Living on Purpose this week. Take care of yourselves.